This morning we are starting in the book of Ecclesiastes with the general subject of comparatively speaking are better things. Some things indeed are better than others, and it's usually things that we have a choice. But as we change from the book of Proverbs to the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll be looking at chapter 4 this morning, we need to remember that Ecclesiastes is written from a different perspective than the book of Proverbs is written, because the book of Proverbs is written as a compendium of wise sayings based on the experiences of life, and also considering that there is a God and that there is life after death and that there is hope in difficult circumstances through the aid and grace of Almighty God. While the book of Ecclesiastes is written from the viewpoint of human experience and experimentation, the idea is that what can I find out about life by living life? What can I find out about what's important by involving myself in one thing after another through experimentation until I find out what's important and what isn't important? I will live a certain way for a while, and I will see if this is what life is all about. I will live a certain while this way and see if I can find some kind of heartfelt, deep, abiding satisfaction. So we're looking at the book of Ecclesiastes from the viewpoint of life's experiences, things that the writer Solomon may have experienced or things that he may have seen, or perhaps something that someone has told him, someone in whom he has great confidence. So let's look now at some of these things that are said to be better than others. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 6 is our first one. Better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Sometimes having all you can eat is a difficult thing because you can't eat it all. I'm going to say it again. Sometimes having all you can eat isn't everything you thought it would be, because sometime in the circumstances of having all you can eat, you can't eat it all. And probably in our lifetime, some way, somehow, we have been at a table that has been set with an abundant amount of fantastic food. That is, special things cooked a special way. And yet we did not enjoy that meal at all. In fact, we may have gone away partially hungry, partially filled, perhaps even with a little indigestion, perhaps a little bit of pain in us because of the anxiety of sitting down and eating in the midst of what our writer calls vexation and travail. Whenever you've a table that groans under the weight of food, and yet those people who sit around it involve themselves in anger and bitterness and quarrelsomeness, sometimes you just want to get up and walk away from it and take whatever food you can get your hands on and go somewhere to a very quiet place and just sit down in quietness and eat some bread and cheese and drink a little iced tea. It just seems better. And that's what our writer's saying. That to have just a little bit with quietness have just a handful with peace and contentment. It's a lot better than having a table filled and yet to participate in the eating of it with those who are disgruntled and unhappy and contentious, and that all we can think about is trouble and travail and anxiety. What he's saying is that happiness does not depend upon the amount of food that we have, that happiness is in the heart and not in the stomach, that you can eat all you can hold and still be filled with meanness, or you can have a little bit and be a fine person and have all of your life put together. I don't know. In fact, this is forbidden in the book of Ecclesiastes when it says, "Say not thou, why were the former days better than these days?" The writer says, don't say that. But I think there was a time when things were less complicated. And I think in my own life that I've been able to sit down in quietness with less and be a happy man. And I think many of you have experienced the same thing. But I think I've been in other circumstances, and I thank God I do not speak of my own home when I say this, although our home has had problems from time to time, but I thank God that our family's had the quietness of spirit that we've had. There have been other times when I've not enjoyed the very best of food because of the attitude that existed at the table where I sat to eat. And I believe that you've experienced these things also. So, better is a handful eaten in quietness and meekness and humility and thanksgiving before God than to have both hands full and have anxiety, anger, disappointment, accusation. Now let's look in the same chapter, verse 9 of chapter 4. And this is something that I think that we would say, if we were to comment on it after reading it, that it don't take no rocket scientist to figure that out, preacher. Verse 9, two are better than one. And he's going to tell us why. I'm glad, aren't you? Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. I think he's pointing out the loner, the person, male or female, who says, I don't need anyone else. I have my career to think about. I have my life to live. I have my goals, and my goals do not include other people. I cannot achieve the goal that I have set before me with a husband or with a wife or perhaps children, God forbid, children, weighing me down and destroying my potential as a person. So I will achieve my goals if I have to live my life without a partner, without a married partner, if you please. I think today we would include that it certainly would not involve abstinence from sex. We can live in, they used to call it shack up, with whomsoever we please. And it's such an obvious thing now that we do not violate the mores and customs of our society. Two are better than one. And that has to do with this life, in this life, the way things are, because two paychecks are better than one. two working at something get more than when one works at something. Two mowing the yard is better than two washing the dishes. Now, is there any gender bias there? Perhaps there is. Doesn't it make life better when you've got somebody to help you? I don't care what it is. I guess that you could even say that there's some truth to this when you consider Bonnie and Clyde. Maybe not. Maybe that's stretching it way out there. But two people living their lives in harmony together are more productive, not only in the idea of gathering money, they're more productive in peace, they're more productive in tranquility, they're more productive in love. Two people living in harmony in the way that God has intended is a beautiful thing for everybody involved. He says, "For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But to him that is alone, when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone?" The nights do get cold in Arkansas, don't they? And I see advertisements in the classified sections from time to time for SWF. And I finally figured that out, that short white female. And I told my wife, your kind are really in demand. I mean, I see a lot of that. I don't know if she doesn't real have a real good sense of humor. But isn't it nice? And just take this, just look at it very calmly. Isn't it nice to have a companion to share things with, to be a part of one another's life? And even the most obvious, that sharing one another's bed and sharing one another's heat, sharing one another's body heat, is one of those simple blessings that comes as a result of surrendering ourselves to one another, just being near one another in the nighttime. And then if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. You know, you've got you and someone else, and you put you and someone else together, and that makes three. That is, you've got this person and this person, and then the union of these persons, and all of these make three. So a threefold cord is not easily broken, because two and two make three in what this writer is proclaiming. Two and one don't make two. You've got this one and this one, and then their cooperative efforts make another thing, so that when you twist the two things together, you have something that cannot be broken easily. And what he's saying is this: the man, the wife, and their union as men, as a man and woman who love one another, makes a strong cord. The man, the woman, and their union. And this is not easily broken. And our next one is verse 13. There are several here in this particular chapter. And this creates a political circumstance, literally. Notice how varied these subjects are. They leap from one thing to another. They're just sort of like, oh, I thought of this too. And yes, by the way, had you ever thought of? But here we enter the realm of politics. Politics of the monarchy. Politics of kings and princes and sons and bloodlines and inheritance. Something like the Stuarts and the Tudors in the history of England, where they constantly plotted against one another, each one trying to gain the throne and dethrone the other. One the advocate of Roman Catholicism, the other the advocate of Anglicanism and perhaps even Independentism, and each one trying in the name of God to do away with the other and come to the throne and not only have the crown of the state but also the crown of the church. Well, there was a lot of intrigue, a lot of killing, a lot of isolation, and a lot of serious problems. Better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished. For out of prison he comes to reign, whereas also he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. I considered all the living which walk under the sun with a second child that shall stand up in his stead. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. They also that come after shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of the spirit. For some reason, the king has gone to jail. He's been placed in prison. And the reason that he's been placed in prison is because he's done something dumb. He's a foolish person. He has not kept his life as it should be. He did some thing that was a foolish thing to do, and as a result of it, he's lost his kingdom, but they have not slain him. They have not left him in some other foreign land, but they have simply imprisoned him. And after he spent some time in prison, perhaps several years, he is released again and recognized as the king of the realm. But he is old and he is still foolish. And he still hasn't learned his lesson. He still cannot be educated. It seems that foolish decisions are bound up in him so that he can make decisions, but they're not good decisions. And so to this old and foolish king who comes from the prison to reign over the people and to rule them, his foolish decisions impoverish the nation. And with these circumstances in mind, better is a poor and wise child. He's simply saying there are some children of low birth. There is a child in our kingdom who is of poor parentage, but he has sense, has good common sense. And a kid born in the home of a white trash family that has some moral convictions and some ethics, and the kid's been taught to make good decisions, he'd be a better king than this old and foolish monarch that has, by his stupidity, brought us all to poverty. And I considered all the living which walk under the sun with a second child that shall stand up in his stead. He said, the old and foolish king does have a second child. Perhaps this wise person here that's poor and wise may be the king's first child, but there is a second child. that is involved in this. Perhaps Solomon had someone in mind. We do not know who it was, but there is a second child involved in this intrigue. And he's saying, when I considered the second child of this king being brought to power, I didn't think things would be much better. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. They also that come after shall not rejoice in him. That is, even his progeny. Those who follow after him, even to the second son who may have had a different mother, they all have a heavy dose of the king's mentality, of his thinking. They all have a character like his. So it doesn't make any difference if the old foolish king reigns. Doesn't make any difference if the first son reigns. Doesn't make any difference if the second son reigns. It doesn't make any difference. That whole family is flawed and foolish. And we'd be a lot better if we just pick some person out of the per subjects whose kid's been raised right and can make good decisions. I think the emphasis is this, that sometimes you get bad government and you can't get rid of it. Sometimes you get a bad king, you can't get rid of it. There seems to be a manner in which it perpetuates itself, and always to the harm and hurt of the people. Let's look now at Ecclesiastes 6:3. Which is the last scriptures we'll look at today, or rather this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 3, if a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. For he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun, nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. Yes, though he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to one place? All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. As we look at these verses of Scripture, they describe a person who achieves a tremendous amount in his life. And the achievement is marked in the statement, if a man beget 100 children. You remember that we're looking at a time when a man's well-being was measured by the number of children he had, in the sense of how well he stood in God's eyes. That is, if man had a lot of children, it was conclusive evidence that the man was highly favored of Almighty God. So we're looking at this metaphorical statement, if a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, but his soul be not filled with good. That is, he's never achieved peace with himself and peace with God. And that people have been hurt by him, even his own family members have been so abused and hurt by him, that at his death they erect no monument. Now, we're not talking about a headstone. We're talking about a marker worthy of a wealthy and successful man. At his death, they simply take him and drop him in the earth, cover his corpse with dirt, and let the animals graze over it so that the place of his burial is unknown to any other generation. A way of showing scorn and showing that a man's life would have been better had he not existed. And that's what we read in these next verses. And any time you see a person who has the attitude, "I wish I'd never been born," that is probably the ultimate of all the statements that we could make. To wish we had never been born, or to wish that our mother had aborted us when we were a fetus, or to wish that we had been stillborn, is probably the very depth of depression and self-hatred and self-loathing and the greatest statement of failure that any man or woman might ever make. He says, "I say that an untimely birth is better than he." Perhaps this is an abortion. Perhaps it is simply to be stillborn, that is dead. "For as a stillborn person, he comes with vanity," that is emptiness, no direction, "departs in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun, nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other." In other words, the baby that's born dead has more rest than this man who's born and has many children, has a lot of wealth, cannot come to grips with himself, who becomes a user of people and becomes such an enemy of himself and his family that when he dies, they simply drop him in the grave. And everything ends there, and he's saying it's better simply not to have been born, or it's better to have been born dead than to have this kind of existence, because, "Yea, though he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to the one place?" And that's the grave. See, that's without God. That's without the Bible. That's without revelation. And he's saying, hey, if this person is still born, he doesn't have all the agony that this guy went through that had all this blessing, quotation marks. And if his memory or his existence, who knows how long it is, he might live, you know, as a being born a dead infant, he might exist 2,000 years. Who knows how long there might be something that'd go on. Who knows? I mean, we don't know. We don't know whether there's a God or not a God. We don't know what's after death. We don't know what's after life. We don't even know what's good and what's bad. But I'd rather just sleep and be totally untouched by all of the disappointments of life than to have all these disappointments and not have anyone appreciate who I am and what I do. And verse 7 is a pretty pessimistic view of life. "All the labor of man is for his mouth." Every ounce of sweat, every hour of education, every hour spent in learning one's trade, every moment of diligence and planning, all comes down to this, that everything we do is just put in a man's mouth. It's just so we can eat. And yet, it is still hungry all the time. We work for our appetite, and our appetite's never satisfied. That's a pessimistic view of life, isn't it? Spend all of our time working, laboring, sweating, toiling, planning. 3 times a day, we put everything we've earned in our mouth. And even if we eat a late snack, we wake up hungry the next morning, and that drives us back to work again. So what he's saying is that men, knowing not God, men who may achieve a lot of wealth, work for their appetite, and their appetite is never satisfied. It's always the idea of more, and that's what covetousness means. It means you want more. And a man with $1 million can be covetous. A family with $10 million can be covetous because they want more. And it takes more. The only way we'll be happy is to have more. You can have $50 million and be filled with covetousness because covetousness is simply wanting more. You can have a dollar and be covetous because all you want is another one. And all of it is to heap upon our appetites, to satisfy the cravings of our flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. All of these things are what we try to satisfy. It's what we make money to heap upon, and it's what we save money for. It's our goal is to satisfy the itchings and the cravings of the flesh in all of its varied and myriad and variegated forms. But when it's all over, every aspect of our fleshly desire still is left unsatisfied, and perhaps even the craving is awakened to a higher level, so that now we want it more desperately than we ever had before. It's like drugs. In the beginning, a tiny amount is all we need, but then a larger amount and a larger amount until we cannot find enough to satisfy our craving. And that's the way flesh is, whether it's saved flesh or lost flesh. That's just the nature of flesh. So he's saying, with that in mind, might as well be stillborn, because life is never going to be anything except one mass attempt to satisfy even a masser or greater appetite.